This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions, by Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths, performed by Brian Christian.
Introduction. Algorithms to Live By. Imagine you're searching for an apartment in San Francisco, arguably the most harrowing American city in which to do so. The booming tech sector and tight zoning laws limiting new construction have conspired to make the city just as expensive as New York, and by many accounts more competitive. New listings go up and come down within minutes. Open houses are mobbed, and often the keys end up in the hands of whoever can physically foist a deposit check on the landlord first. Such a savage market leaves little room for the kind of fact-finding and deliberation that is theoretically supposed to characterize the doings of the rational consumer. Unlike, say, a mall patron or an online shopper who can compare options before making a decision, the would-be San Franciscan has to decide instantly either way. You can take the apartment you are currently looking at, forsaking all others, or you can walk away, never to return. Let's assume for a moment, for the sake of simplicity, that you care only about maximizing your chance of getting the very best apartment available. Your goal is reducing the twin Scylla and Charybdis regrets of the one that got away and the stone left unturned to the absolute minimum. You run into a dilemma right off the bat. How are you to know that an apartment is indeed the best unless you have a baseline to judge it by? And how are you to establish that baseline unless you look at and lose a number of apartments? The more information you gather, the better you'll know the right opportunity when you see it, but the more likely you are to have already passed it by. So what do you do? How do you make an informed decision when the very act of informing it jeopardizes the outcome? It's a cruel situation, bordering on paradox. When presented with this kind of problem, most people will intuitively say something to the effect that it requires some sort of balance between looking and leaping, that you must look at enough apartments to establish a standard, then take whatever satisfies the standard you've established. This notion of balance is, in fact, precisely correct. What most people don't say with any certainty is what that balance is. Fortunately, there's an answer. 37%. If you want the best odds of getting the best apartment, spend 37% of your apartment hunt, 11 days if you've given yourself a month for the search, non-committally exploring options. Leave the checkbook at home, you're just calibrating. But after that point, be prepared to immediately commit, deposit and all, to the very first place you see that beats whatever you've already seen. This is not merely an intuitively satisfying compromise between looking and leaping. It is the provably optimal solution. We know this because finding an apartment belongs to a class of mathematical problems known as optimal stopping problems. The 37% rule defines a simple series of steps, what computer scientists call an algorithm, for solving these problems. And as it turns out, apartment hunting is just one of the ways that optimal stopping rears its head in daily life. Committing to or foregoing a succession of options is a structure that appears in life again and again, in slightly different incarnations. How many times to circle the block before pulling into a parking space? How far to push your luck with a risky business venture before cashing out? How long to hold out for a better offer on that house or car? The same challenge also appears in an even more fraught setting. Dating. Optimal stopping is the science of serial monogamy. Simple algorithms offer solutions not only to an apartment hunt, but to all such situations in life where we confront the question of optimal stopping. People grapple with these issues every day, although surely poets have spilled more ink on the tribulations of courtship than of parking. And they do so with, in some cases, considerable anguish. But the anguish is unnecessary. Mathematically, at least, these are solved problems. Every harried renter, driver, and suitor you see around as you go through a typical week is essentially reinventing the wheel. They don't need a therapist. They need an algorithm. The therapist tells them to find the right comfortable balance between impulsivity and overthinking. The algorithm tells them the balance is 37%. There is a particular set of problems that all people face. Problems that are a direct result of the fact that our lives are carried out in finite space and time. What should we do and leave undone in a day or in a decade? What degree of mess should we embrace? And how much order is excessive? What balance between new experiences and favored ones makes for the most fulfilling life? These might seem like problems unique to humans. They're not. For more than half a century, computer scientists have been grappling with, and in many cases solving, the equivalents of these everyday dilemmas. How should a processor allocate its attention to perform all that the user asks of it with the minimum overhead and in the least amount of time? When should it switch between different tasks, and how many tasks should it take on in the first place? What is the best way for it to use its limited memory resources? Should it collect more data or take an action based on the data it already has? Seizing the day might be a challenge for humans, but computers all around us are seizing milliseconds with ease. And there's much we can learn from how they do it. Talking about algorithms for human lives might seem like an odd juxtaposition. For many people, the word algorithm evokes the arcane and inscrutable machinations of big data, big government, and big business, increasingly part of the infrastructure of the modern world, but hardly a source of practical wisdom or guidance for human affairs. But an algorithm is just a finite sequence of steps used to solve a problem. And algorithms are much broader and older by far than the computer. Long before algorithms were ever used by machines, they were used by people. The word algorithm comes from the name of Persian mathematician Al-Khwarizmi, author of a 9th century book of techniques for doing mathematics by hand. His book was called Al-Jabr wal-Muqabala, and the Al-Jabr of the title in turn provides the source of our word algebra. The earliest known mathematical algorithms, however, predate even Al-Khwarizmi's work. A 4,000-year-old Sumerian clay tablet found near Baghdad describes a scheme for long division. But algorithms are not confined to mathematics alone. When you cook bread from a recipe, you're following an algorithm. When you knit a sweater from a pattern, you're following an algorithm. When you put a sharp edge on a piece of flint by executing a precise sequence of strikes with the end of an antler, a key step in making fine stone tools, you're following an algorithm. Algorithms have been a part of human technology ever since the Stone Age. In this book, we explore the idea of human algorithm design, searching for better solutions to the challenges people encounter every day. Applying the lens of computer science to everyday life has consequences at many scales. Most immediately, it offers us practical, concrete suggestions for how to solve specific problems. Optimal stopping tells us when to look and when to leap. The explore-exploit trade-off tells us how to find the balance between trying new things and enjoying our favorites. Sorting theory tells us how and whether to arrange our offices. Caching theory tells us how to fill our closets. Scheduling theory tells us how to fill our time. At the next level, computer science gives us a vocabulary for understanding the deeper principles at play in each of these domains. As Carl Sagan put it, science is a way of thinking much more than it is a body of knowledge. Even in cases where life is too messy for us to expect a strict numerical analysis or a ready answer, using intuitions and concepts honed on the simpler forms of these problems offers us a way to understand the key issues and make progress. Most broadly, looking through the lens of computer science can teach us about the nature of the human mind, the meaning of rationality, and the oldest question of all, how to live. Examining cognition as a means of solving the fundamentally computational problems posed by our environment can utterly change the way we think about human rationality. The notion that studying the inner workings of computers might reveal how to think and decide, what to believe and how to behave, might strike many people as not only wildly reductive, but in fact misguided. Even if computer science did have things to say about how to think and how to act, would we want to listen? We look at the AIs and robots of science fiction, and it seems like theirs is not a life any of us would want to live. In part, that's because when we think about computers, we think about coldly mechanical, deterministic systems, machines applying rigid deductive logic, making decisions by exhaustively enumerating the options, and grinding out the exact right answer, no matter how long and hard they have to think. Indeed, the person who first imagined computers had something essentially like this in mind. Alan Turing defined the very notion of computation by an analogy to a human mathematician who carefully works through the steps of a lengthy calculation, yielding an unmistakably right answer. So it might come as a surprise that this is not what modern computers are actually doing when they face a difficult problem. Straightforward arithmetic, of course, isn't particularly challenging for a modern computer. Rather, it's tasks like conversing with people, fixing a corrupted file, or winning a game of Go. Problems where the rules aren't clear, some of the required information is missing, or finding exactly the right answer would require considering an astronomical number of possibilities that now pose the biggest challenges in computer science. And the algorithms that researchers have developed to solve the hardest classes of problems have moved computers away from an extreme reliance on exhaustive calculation. Instead, tackling real-world tasks requires being comfortable with chance, trading off time with accuracy, and using approximations. As computers become better tuned to real-world problems, they provide not only algorithms that people can borrow for their own lives, but a better standard against which to compare human cognition itself. Over the past decade or two, behavioral economics has told a very particular story about human beings, that we are irrational and error-prone, owing in large part to the buggy, idiosyncratic hardware of the brain. This self-deprecating story has become increasingly familiar, but certain questions remain vexing. Why are 4-year-olds, for instance, still better than million-dollar supercomputers at a host of cognitive tasks, including vision, language, and causal reasoning? The solutions to everyday problems that come from computer science tell a different story about the human mind. Life is full of problems that are quite simply hard. And the mistakes made by people often say more about the intrinsic difficulties of the problem than about the fallibility of human brains. Thinking algorithmically about the world, learning about the fundamental structures of the problems we face and about the properties of their solutions, can help us see how good we actually are and better understand the errors that we make. In fact, human beings turn out to consistently confront some of the hardest cases of the problems studied by computer scientists. Often, people need to make decisions while dealing with uncertainty, time constraints, partial information, and a rapidly changing world. In some of those cases, even cutting-edge computer science has not yet come up with efficient, always-right algorithms. For certain situations, it appears that such algorithms might not exist at all. Even where perfect algorithms haven't been found, however, the battle between generations of computer scientists and the most intractable real-world problems has yielded a series of insights. These hard-won precepts are at odds with our intuitions about rationality, and they don't sound anything like the narrow prescriptions of a mathematician trying to force the world into clean, formal lines. They say, don't always consider all your options. Don't necessarily go for the outcome that seems best every time. Make a mess on occasion. Travel light. Let things wait. Trust your instincts and don't think too long. Relax. Toss a coin. Forgive, but don't forget. To thine own self, be true. Living by the wisdom of computer science doesn't sound so bad after all. And unlike most advice, it's backed up by proofs. Just as designing algorithms for computers was originally a subject that fell into the cracks between disciplines, an odd hybrid of mathematics and engineering, so too, designing algorithms for humans is a topic that doesn't have a natural disciplinary home. Today, algorithm design draws not only on computer science, math, and engineering, but on kindred fields like statistics and operations research. And as we consider how algorithms designed for machines might relate to human minds, we also need to look to cognitive science, psychology, economics, and beyond. We, your authors, are familiar with this interdisciplinary territory. Tom studied psychology and statistics before becoming a professor at UC Berkeley, where he spends most of his time thinking about the relationship between human cognition and computation. I studied computer science and philosophy before going on to graduate work in English and a career at the intersection of the three. But nobody can be an expert in all of the fields that are relevant to designing better algorithms for humans. So as part of our quest for algorithms to live by, we talked to the people who came up with some of the most famous algorithms of the last 50 years. And we asked them, some of the smartest people in the world, how their research influenced the way they approached their own lives, from finding their spouses to sorting their socks. In a moment, we begin our journey through some of the biggest challenges faced by computers and human minds alike. How to manage finite space, finite time, limited attention, unknown unknowns, incomplete information, and an unforeseeable future. How to do so with grace and confidence. And how to do so in a community with others who are all simultaneously trying to do the same. We will learn about the fundamental mathematical structure of these challenges, and about how computers are engineered, sometimes counter to what we imagine, to make the most of them. And we will learn about how the mind works, about its distinct but deeply related ways of tackling the same set of issues and coping with the same constraints. Ultimately, what we can gain is not only a set of concrete takeaways for the problems around us, not only a new way to see the elegant structures behind even the hairiest human dilemmas, not only a recognition of the travails of humans and computers as deeply conjoined, but something even more profound. A new vocabulary for the world around us, and a chance to learn something truly new about ourselves. 1. Optimal stopping. When to stop looking. Though all Christians start a wedding invitation by solemnly declaring their marriage is due to special divine arrangement, I, as a philosopher, would like to talk in greater detail about this. Johannes Kepler. If you prefer Mr. Martin to every other person, if you think him the most agreeable man you have ever been in company with, why should you hesitate? Jane Austen, Emma. It's such a common phenomenon that college guidance counselors even have a slang term for it, the turkey drop. High school sweethearts come home for Thanksgiving of their freshman year of college and, 4 days later, return to campus single. As an angst-ridden teenager, I went to my own college guidance counselor my freshman year. My high school girlfriend had gone to a different college several states away, and we struggled with the distance. We also struggled with a stranger and more philosophical question. How good a relationship did we have? We had no real benchmark of other relationships by which to judge it. My counselor recognized ours as a classic freshman year dilemma, and was surprisingly nonchalant in her advice. Gather data. The nature of serial monogamy, writ large, is that its practitioners are confronted with a fundamental, unavoidable problem. When have you met enough people to know who your best match is? And what if acquiring the data costs you that very match? It seems the ultimate catch-22 of the heart. As we have seen, this catch-22, this angsty freshman cri de coeur, is what mathematicians call an optimal stopping problem. And it may actually have an answer. 37%. Of course, it all depends on the assumptions you're willing to make about love. The secretary problem. In any optimal stopping problem, the crucial dilemma is not which option to pick, but how many options to even consider. These problems turn out to have implications not only for lovers and renters, but also for drivers, homeowners, burglars, and beyond. The 37% rule derives from Optimal Stopping's most famous puzzle, which has come to be known as the secretary problem. Its setup is much like the apartment hunter's dilemma that we considered earlier. Imagine you're interviewing a set of applicants for a position as a secretary, and your goal is to maximize the chance of hiring the single best applicant in the pool. While you have no idea how to assign scores to individual applicants, you can easily judge which one you prefer. A mathematician might say you have access only to the ordinal numbers, the relative ranks of the applicants compared to each other, but not to the cardinal numbers, their ratings on some kind of general scale. You interview the applicants in random order, one at a time. You can decide to offer the job to an applicant at any point, and they are guaranteed to accept, terminating the search. But if you pass over an applicant, deciding not to hire them, they are gone forever. The secretary problem is widely considered to have made its first appearance in print, sans explicit mention of secretaries, in the February 1960 issue of Scientific American, as one of several puzzles posed in Martin Gardner's beloved column on recreational mathematics. But the origins of the problem are surprisingly mysterious. Our own initial search yielded little but speculation before turning into unexpectedly physical detective work, a road trip down to the archive of Gardner's papers at Stanford to haul out boxes of his mid-century correspondence. Reading paper correspondence is a bit like eavesdropping on someone who's on the phone. You're only hearing one side of the exchange and must infer the other. In our case, we only had the replies to what was apparently Gardner's own search for the problem's origins 50-some years ago. The more we read, the more tangled and unclear the story became. Harvard mathematician Frederick Mosteller recalled hearing about the problem in 1955 from his colleague Andrew Gleason, who had heard about it from somebody else. Leo Moser wrote from the University of Alberta to say that he read about the problem in, quote, some notes by R.E. Gaskell of Boeing, who himself credited a colleague. Roger Pinkham of Rutgers wrote that he first heard of the problem in 1955 from Duke University mathematician Jay Schoenfield, quote, and I believe he said that he had heard the problem from someone at Michigan. Someone at Michigan was almost certainly someone named Merrill Flood. Though he is largely unheard of outside mathematics, Flood's influence on computer science is almost impossible to avoid. He's credited with popularizing the traveling salesman problem, which we discuss in more detail in Chapter 8, devising the prisoner's dilemma, which we discuss in Chapter 11, and even with possibly coining the term software. It's Flood who made the first known discovery of the 37% rule in 1958. And he claims to have been considering the problem since 1949, but he himself points back to several other mathematicians. Suffice it to say that wherever it came from, the secretary problem proved to be a near-perfect mathematical puzzle. Simple to explain, devilish to solve, succinct in its answer, and intriguing in its implications. As a result, it moved like wildfire through the mathematical circles of the 1950s, spreading by word of mouth, and thanks to Gardner's column in 1960, came to grip the imagination of the public at large. By the 1980s, the problem and its variations had produced so much analysis that it had come to be discussed in papers as a subfield unto itself. As for secretaries, it's charming to watch each culture put its own anthropological spin on formal systems. We think of chess, for instance, as medieval European in its imagery, but in fact its origins are in 8th century India. It was heavy-handedly Europeanized in the 15th century, as its shahs became kings, its viziers turned to queens, and its elephants became bishops. Likewise, optimal stopping problems have had a number of incarnations, each reflecting the predominating concerns of its time. In the 19th century, such problems were typified by Baroque lotteries and by women choosing male suitors. In the early 20th century, by holidaying motorists searching for hotels and by male suitors choosing women. And in the paper-pushing, male-dominated mid-20th century, by male bosses choosing female assistants. The first explicit mention of it by name as the secretary problem appears to be in a 1964 paper, and somewhere along the way, the name stuck. Whence 37%? In your search for a secretary, there are two ways you can fail: stopping early and stopping late. When you stop too early, you leave the best applicant undiscovered. When you stop too late, you hold out for a better applicant who doesn't exist. The optimal strategy will clearly require finding the right balance between the two, walking the tightrope between looking too much and not enough. If your aim is finding the very best applicant, settling for nothing less, it's clear that as you go through the interview process, you shouldn't even consider hiring somebody who isn't the best you've seen so far. However, simply being the best yet isn't enough for an offer. The very first applicant, for example, will of course be the best yet by definition. More generally, it stands to reason that the rate at which we encounter best yet applicants will go down as we proceed in our interviews. For instance, the second applicant has a 50-50 chance of being the best we've yet seen, but the fifth applicant only has a 1 in 5 chance of being the best so far. The sixth has a 1 in 6 chance, and so on. As a result, best yet applicants will become steadily more impressive as the search continues. By definition, again, they're better than all those who came before. But they will also become more and more infrequent. Okay, so we know that taking the first best yet applicant we encounter, aka the first applicant period, is rash. If there are 100 applicants, it also seems hasty to make an offer to the next one who's best yet, just because she was better than the first. So how do we proceed? Intuitively, there are a few potential strategies. For instance, making an offer the third time an applicant trumps everyone seen so far, or maybe the fourth time. Or perhaps taking the next best yet applicant to come along after a long drought, a long streak of poor applicants. But as it happens, neither of these relatively sensible strategies comes out on top. Instead, the optimal solution takes the form of what we'll call the look-then-leap rule. You set a predetermined amount of time for looking, that is, exploring your options, gathering data, in which you categorically don't choose anyone, no matter how impressive. After that point, you enter the leap phase, prepared to instantly commit to anyone who outshines the best applicant you saw in the look phase. We can see how the look-then-leap rule emerges by considering how the secretary problem plays out in the smallest applicant pools. With just one applicant, the problem is easy to solve. Hire her. With two applicants, you have a 50-50 chance of success, no matter what you do. You can hire the first applicant, who will turn out to be the best half the time, or dismiss the first and by default hire the second, who is also best half the time. Add a third applicant, and all of a sudden, things get interesting. The odds if we hire at random are one-third, or 33%. With two applicants, we could do no better than chance. With three, can we? It turns out we can. And it all comes down to what we do with the second interviewee. When we see the first applicant, we have no information. She'll always appear to be the best yet. When we see the third applicant, we have no agency. We have to make an offer to the final applicant since we've dismissed the others. But when we see the second applicant, we have a little bit of both. We know whether she's better or worse than the first, and we have the freedom to either hire or dismiss her. What happens when we just hire her if she's better than the first applicant and dismiss her if she's not? This turns out to be the best possible strategy when facing three applicants. Using this approach, it's possible, surprisingly, to do just as well in the three-applicant problem as with two, choosing the best applicant exactly half the time. Enumerating these scenarios for four applicants tells us that we should still begin to leap as soon as the second applicant. With five applicants in the pool, we shouldn't leap before the third. As the applicant pool grows, the exact place to draw the line between looking and leaping settles to 37% of the pool, yielding the 37% rule. Look at the first 37% of the applicants, choosing none, then be ready to leap for anyone better than all of those you've seen so far. As it turns out, following this optimal strategy ultimately gives us a 37% chance of hiring the best applicant. It's one of the problem's curious mathematical symmetries, that the strategy itself and its chance of success work out to the very same number. A 63% failure rate when following the best possible strategy is a sobering fact. Even when we act optimally in the secretary problem, we will still fail most of the time. That is, we won't end up with the single best applicant in the pool. This is bad news for those of us who would frame romance as a search for the one. But here's the silver lining. Intuition would suggest that our chances of picking the single best applicant should steadily decrease as the applicant pool grows. If we were hiring at random, for instance, then in a pool of 100 applicants, we'd have a 1% chance of success. And in a pool of 1,000,000 applicants, we'd have a 0.0001% chance. Yet remarkably, the math of the secretary problem doesn't change. If you're stopping optimally, your chance of finding the single best applicant in a pool of 100 is 37%. And in a pool of 1,000,000, believe it or not, your chance is still 37%. Thus, the bigger the applicant pool gets, the more valuable knowing the optimal algorithm becomes. It's true that you're unlikely to find the needle the majority of the time, but optimal stopping is your best defense against the haystack, no matter how large. Lover's Leap. The passion between the sexes has appeared in every age to be so nearly the same that it may always be considered in algebraic language as a given quantity. Thomas Malthus. I married the first man I ever kissed. When I tell this to my children, they just about throw up. Barbara Bush. Before he became a professor of operations research at Carnegie Mellon, Michael Trick was a graduate student looking for love. It hit me that the problem has been studied. It is the secretary problem. I had a position to fill and a series of applicants, and my goal was to pick the best applicant for the position. So he ran the numbers. He didn't know how many women he could expect to meet in his lifetime. But there's a certain flexibility in the 37% rule. It can be applied to either the number of applicants or the time over which one is searching. Assuming that his search would run from ages 18 to 40, the 37% rule gave age 26.1 years as the point at which to switch from looking to leaping. A number that, as it happened, was exactly Trick's age at the time. So when he found a woman who was a better match than all those he had dated so far, he knew exactly what to do. He leapt. I didn't know if she was perfect. The assumptions of the model didn't allow me to determine that. But there was no doubt that she met the qualifications for this step of the algorithm. So I proposed, he writes, and she turned me down. Mathematicians have been having trouble with love since at least the 17th century. The legendary astronomer Johannes Kepler is today perhaps best remembered for discovering that planetary orbits are elliptical and for being a crucial part of the Copernican Revolution that included Galileo and Newton and upended humanity's sense of its place in the heavens. But Kepler had terrestrial concerns too. After the death of his first wife in 1611, Kepler embarked on a long and arduous quest to remarry, ultimately courting a total of 11 women. Of the first four, Kepler liked the fourth the best, because of her tall build and athletic body, but did not cease his search. It would have been settled, Kepler wrote, had not both love and reason forced a fifth woman on me. This one won me over with love, humble loyalty, economy of household, diligence, and the love she gave the stepchildren. However, he wrote, I continued. Kepler's friends and relations went on making introductions for him, and he kept on looking, but half-heartedly. His thoughts remained with number five. After 11 courtships in total, he decided he would search no further. While preparing to travel to Regensburg, I returned to the fifth woman, declared myself, and was accepted. Kepler and Susanna Reutinger were wed and had six children together, along with the children from Kepler's first marriage. Biographies describe the rest of Kepler's domestic life as a particularly peaceful and joyous time. Both Kepler and Trick, in opposite ways, experienced firsthand some of the ways that the secretary problem oversimplifies the search for love. In the classical secretary problem, applicants always accept the position, preventing the rejection experienced by Trick. And they cannot be recalled once passed over, contrary to the strategy followed by Kepler. In the decades since the secretary problem was first introduced, a wide range of variants on the scenario have been studied, with strategies for optimal stopping worked out under a number of different conditions. The possibility of rejection, for instance, has a straightforward mathematical solution. Propose early and often. If you have, say, a 50-50 chance of being rejected, then the same kind of mathematical analysis that yielded the 37% rule says you should start making offers after just a quarter of your search. If turned down, keep making offers to every best-yet person you see until somebody accepts. With such a strategy, your chance of overall success, that is, proposing and being accepted by the best applicant in the pool, will also be 25%. Not such terrible odds, perhaps, for a scenario that combines the obstacle of rejection with the general difficulty of establishing one's standards in the first place. Kepler, for his part, decried the restlessness and doubtfulness that pushed him to keep on searching. Was there no other way for my uneasy heart to be content with its fate, he bemoaned in a letter to a confidant, than by realizing the impossibility of the fulfillment of so many other desires? Here again, optimal stopping theory provides some measure of consolation. Rather than being signs of moral or psychological degeneracy, restlessness and doubtfulness actually turn out to be part of the best strategy for scenarios where second chances are possible. If you can recall previous applicants, the optimal algorithm puts a twist on the familiar look-then-leap rule, a longer non-committal period, and a fallback plan. For example, assume an immediate proposal is a sure thing, but belated proposals are rejected half the time. Then the math says you should keep looking non-committally until you've seen 61% of applicants, and then only leap if someone in the remaining 39% of the pool proves to be the best yet. If you're still single after considering all the possibilities, as Kepler was, then go back to the best one that got away. The symmetry between strategy and outcome holds in this case once again. With your chances of ending up with the best applicant under the second chances allowed scenario also being 61%. For Kepler, the difference between reality and the classical secretary problem brought with it a happy ending. In fact, the twist on the classical problem worked out well for Trick, too. After the rejection, he completed his degree and took a job in Germany. There he walked into a bar, fell in love with a beautiful woman, moved in together 3 weeks later, and invited her to live in the United States for a while. She agreed, and 6 years later, they were wed. Knowing a good thing when you see it. Full information. The first set of variants we considered, rejection and recall, altered the classical secretary problem's assumptions that timely proposals are always accepted, and tardy proposals never. For these variants, the best approach remained the same as in the original. Look noncommittally for a time, then be ready to leap. But there's an even more fundamental assumption of the secretary problem that we might call into question. Namely, in the secretary problem, we know nothing about the applicants other than how they compare to one another. We don't have an objective or pre-existing sense of what makes for a good or a bad applicant. Moreover, when we compare two of them, we know which of the two is better, but not by how much. It's this fact that gives rise to the unavoidable look phase, in which we risk passing up a superb early applicant while we calibrate our expectations and standards. Mathematicians refer to this genre of optimal stopping problems as no-information games. This setup is arguably a far cry from most searches for an apartment, a partner, or even a secretary. Imagine instead that we had some kind of objective criterion. If every secretary, for instance, had taken a typing exam scored by percentile, in the fashion of the SAT or GRE or LSAT. That is, every applicant's score will tell us where they fall among all the typists who took the test. A 51st percentile typist is just above average. A 75th percentile typist is better than 3 test takers out of 4, and so on. Suppose that our applicant pool is representative of the population at large and isn't skewed or self-selected in any way. Furthermore, suppose we decide that typing speed is the only thing that matters about our applicants. Then we have what mathematicians call full information, and everything changes. No buildup of experience is needed to set a standard, as the seminal 1966 paper on the problem put it. And a profitable choice can sometimes be made immediately. In other words, if a 95th percentile applicant happens to be the first one we evaluate, we know it instantly and can confidently hire her on the spot. That is, of course, assuming we don't think there's a 96th percentile applicant in the pool. And there's the rub. If our goal is, again, to get the single best person for the job, we still need to weigh the likelihood that there's a stronger applicant out there. However, the fact that we have full information gives us everything we need to calculate those odds directly. The chance that our next applicant is in the 96th percentile or higher will always be 1 in 20, for instance. Thus, the decision of whether to stop comes down entirely to how many applicants we have left to see. Full information means that we don't need to look before we leap. We can instead use the threshold rule, where we immediately accept an applicant if she is above a certain percentile. We don't need to look at an initial group of applicants to set this threshold, but we do, however, need to be keenly aware of how much looking remains available. The math shows that when there are a lot of applicants left in the pool, you should pass up even a very good applicant in the hopes of finding someone still better than that. But as your options dwindle, you should be prepared to hire anyone who's simply better than average. It's a familiar, if not exactly inspiring, message. In the face of slim pickings, lower your standards. It also makes clear the converse. With more fish in the sea, raise them. In both cases, crucially, the math tells you exactly by how much. The easiest way to understand the numbers for this scenario is to start at the end and think backward. If you're down to the last applicant, of course, you are necessarily forced to choose her. But when looking at the next-to-last applicant, the question becomes, is she above the 50th percentile? If yes, then hire her. If not, it's worth rolling the dice on the last applicant instead, since her odds of being above the 50th percentile are 50-50 by definition. Likewise, you should choose the third-to-last applicant if she's above the 69th percentile, the fourth-to-last applicant if she's above the 78th, and so on. Being more choosy, the more applicants are left. No matter what, never hire someone who's below average unless you're totally out of options. And since you're still interested only in finding the very best person in the applicant pool, never hire someone who isn't the best you've seen so far. The chance of ending up with the single best applicant in this full information version of the secretary problem comes to 58%. Still far from a guarantee, but considerably better than the 37% success rate offered by the 37% rule in the no information game. If you have all the facts, you can succeed more often than not, even as the applicant pool grows arbitrarily large. The full information game thus offers an unexpected and somewhat bizarre takeaway. Gold digging is more likely to succeed than a quest for love. If you're evaluating your partners based on any kind of objective criterion, say their income percentile, then you've got a lot more information at your disposal than if you're after a nebulous emotional response, love, that might require both experience and comparison to calibrate. Of course, there's no reason that net worth, or for that matter, typing speed, needs to be the thing that you're measuring. Any yardstick that provides full information on where an applicant stands relative to the population at large will change the solution from the look-then-leap rule to the threshold rule, and will dramatically boost your chances of finding the single best applicant in the group. There are many more variants of the secretary problem that modify its other assumptions, perhaps bringing it more in line with the real-world challenges of finding love, or a secretary. But the lessons to be learned from optimal stopping aren't limited to dating or hiring. In fact, trying to make the best choice when options only present themselves one by one is also the basic structure of selling a house, parking a car, and quitting when you're ahead. And they're all, to some degree or other, solved problems. When to sell. If we alter two more aspects of the classical secretary problem, we find ourselves catapulted from the realm of dating to the realm of real estate. Earlier, we talked about the process of renting an apartment as an optimal stopping problem, but owning a home has no shortage of optimal stopping either. Imagine selling a house, for instance. After consulting with several real estate agents, you put your place on the market, a new coat of paint, some landscaping, and then it's just a matter of waiting for the offers to come in. As each offer arrives, you typically have to decide whether to accept it or turn it down. But turning down an offer comes at a cost. Another week or month of mortgage payments while you wait for the next offer. which isn't guaranteed to be any better. Selling a house is similar to the full information game. We know the objective dollar value of the offers, telling us not only which ones are better than which, but also by how much. What's more, we have information about the broader state of the market, which enables us to at least roughly predict the range of offers to expect. This gives us the same percentile information about each offer that we had with the typing exam previously. The difference here, however, is that our goal isn't actually to secure the single best offer. It's to make the most money through the process overall. Given that waiting has a cost measured in dollars, a good offer today beats a slightly better one several months from now. Having this information, we don't need to look non-committally to set a threshold. Instead, we can set one going in, ignore everything below it, and take the first option to exceed it. Granted, if we have a limited amount of savings that will run out if we don't sell by a certain time, or if we expect to get only a limited number of offers and no more interest thereafter, then we should lower our standards as such limits approach. There's a reason why home buyers look for motivated sellers. But if neither concern leads us to believe that our backs are against the wall, then we can simply focus on a cost-benefit analysis of the waiting game. Here we'll analyze one of the simplest cases, where we know for certain the price range in which offers will come, and where all offers within that range are equally likely. If we don't have to worry about the offers or our savings running out, then we can think purely in terms of what we can expect to gain or lose by waiting for a better deal. If we decline the current offer, will the chance of a better one, multiplied by how much better we expect it to be, more than compensate for the cost of the wait? As it turns out, the math here is quite clean, giving us an explicit function for stopping price as a function of the cost of waiting for an offer. This particular mathematical result doesn't care whether you're selling a mansion worth millions or a ramshackle shed. The only thing it cares about is the difference between the highest and lowest offers you're likely to receive. By plugging in some concrete figures, we can see how this algorithm offers us a considerable amount of explicit guidance. For instance, let's say the range of offers we're expecting runs from $400,000 to $500,000. First, if the cost of waiting is trivial, we're able to be almost infinitely choosy. If the cost of getting another offer is only a dollar, we'll maximize our earnings by waiting for someone willing to offer us $499,552.79, and not a dime less. If waiting costs $2,000 an offer, we should hold out for an even $480,000. In a slow market, where waiting costs $10,000 an offer, we should take anything over $455,279. Finally, if waiting costs half or more of our expected range of offers, in this case $50,000, then there's no advantage whatsoever to holding out. We'll do best by taking the very first offer that comes along and calling it done. Beggars can't be choosers. The critical thing to note in this problem is that our threshold depends only on the cost of search. Since the chances of the next offer being a good one and the cost of finding out never change, our stopping price has no reason to ever get lower as the search goes on, regardless of our luck. We set it once before we even begin, and then we quite simply hold fast. The University of Wisconsin-Madison's Laura Albert McClay, an optimization expert, recalls turning to her knowledge of optimal stopping problems when it came time to sell her own house. "The first offer we got was great," she explains. "But it had this huge cost because they wanted us to move out a month before we were ready. There was another competitive offer, but we just kind of held out until we got the right one." For many sellers, Turning down a good offer or two can be a nerve-wracking proposition, especially if the ones that immediately follow are no better. But McClay held her ground and stayed cool. "That would have been really, really hard," she admits, "if I didn't know the math was on my side." This principle applies to any situation where you get a series of offers and pay a cost to seek or wait for the next. As a consequence, it's relevant to cases that go far beyond selling a house. For example, economists have used this algorithm to model how people look for jobs, where it handily explains the otherwise seemingly paradoxical fact of unemployed workers and unfilled vacancies existing at the same time. In fact, these variations on the optimal stopping problem have another, even more surprising property. As we saw, the ability to recall a past opportunity was vital in Kepler's quest for love. But in house selling and job hunting, even if it's possible to reconsider an earlier offer, and even if that offer is guaranteed to still be on the table, you should nonetheless never do so. If it wasn't above your threshold then, it won't be above your threshold now. What you've paid to keep searching is a sunk cost. Don't compromise, don't second guess, and don't look back. When to park. I find that the three major administrative problems on a campus are sex for the students, athletics for the alumni, and parking for the faculty. Clark Kerr, president of UC Berkeley, 1958 to 1967. Another domain where optimal stopping problems abound, and where looking back is also generally ill-advised, is the car. Motorists feature in some of the earliest literature on the secretary problem, and the framework of constant forward motion makes almost every car trip decision into a stopping problem. The search for a restaurant, the search for a bathroom, and, most acutely for urban drivers, the search for a parking space. Who better to talk to about the ins and outs of parking than the man described by the Los Angeles Times as the parking rock star, UCLA Distinguished Professor of Urban Planning Donald Shoup. We drove down from Northern California to visit him, reassuring Shoup that we'd be leaving plenty of time for unexpected traffic. As for planning on unexpected traffic, I think you should plan on expected traffic, he replied. Shoup is perhaps best known for his book, The High Cost of Free Parking, and he has done much to advance the discussion and understanding of what really happens when someone drives to their destination. We should pity the poor driver. The ideal parking space, as Shoup models it, is one that optimizes a precise balance between the sticker price of the space, the time and inconvenience of walking, the time taken seeking the space, which varies wildly with destination, time of day, etc., and the gas burned in doing so. The equation changes with the number of passengers in the car who can split the monetary cost of a space, but not the search time or the walk. At the same time, the driver needs to consider that the area with the most parking supply may also be the area with the most demand. Parking has a game-theoretic component, as you try to outsmart the other drivers on the road, while they in turn are trying to outsmart you. That said, many of the challenges of parking boil down to a single number, the occupancy rate. This is the proportion of all parking spots that are currently occupied. If the occupancy rate is low, it's easy to find a good parking spot. If it's high, finding anywhere at all to park is a challenge. Shoup argues that many of the headaches of parking are consequences of cities adopting policies that result in extremely high occupancy rates. If the cost of parking in a particular location is too low, or